Welcome back to Living on Earth and our special, A Little Known Planet. I'm Steve Kerwood. We've heard how both researchers and the lay public can help count up the Earth's creatures. Now we'll see how technology is helping to speed up the identification of species. But first, Living on Earth's Diane Toomey takes us back to Harvard biologist E.O. Wilson to see how things were done the old-fashioned way.
And I have to bring this up a bit. And now the specimen is in view at a relatively low magnification.
The core of Dr. Wilson's book on Phaidolae ants is his detailed line drawings that fill most of its oversized pages. They serve to document the physical characteristics that separate one species from another and allow other taxonomists to compare specimens of their own.
And I'm going to bring up the magnification now so that we can see the specimen at about the magnification I frequently use to make the drawings.
So using a number one pencil, Dr. Wilson made more than 5,000 drawings of soldier and worker ants from various angles, the top, side, from the front, and that meant hours of peering into a microscope.
I will line it up for you to look at, and now you will be able to see this specimen yourself as you peek through. Can you see it?
Oh, my.
And do you see the micrometer there?
A yellow ant sits under a grid that makes the insect easier to draw. I'm staring at Phaidolae caltrop from Panama. At this magnification, its head is spectacularly, hideously large, and a dark, lifeless eye, does the eye of an ant ever look otherwise, stares back at me.
So it's possible then to work off that image and to examine it from every angle.
Then, the little hairs are quite visible.
And you know, for a lot of people, they see one ant, they think they've seen them all. Well, certainly when they see one Phaidolae, they think they've seen them all. But in fact, how long those hairs are, how abundant they are on different parts of the body, the direction that they take is, you know, whether they are stand straight up or they're oblique or whatever, all of these things go into the description. And I've represented them, you see, in the drawing. And they allow you to tell these apart at a glance.
I mean, it did occur to me, looking at these amazingly detailed, fine drawings, that in order to be a good scientist, one had to be a good illustrator.
That's true also. I am no artist, but I'm a moderately good illustrator. So I realized that I wasn't going to climb this Mount Everest of ant taxonomy unless I just put a large amount of personal effort into making the drawing. This was the knitting part of my work.
Yes, you heard right, knitting. That's the leisure activity to which Dr. Wilson compares his hours of drawing. At that point, I realize I have something in common with one of the world's most famous scientists, so I ask him. I knit a bit, and there is something very meditative
right.
about the process.
Yes.
And so I'm wondering if you also found a certain meditative quality to this exercise.
An excellent question. And the answer is yes. Those many, many hours at odd times, on a Saturday night, on a Sunday morning, I sat down with some music in the background and pulled the specimens out and started going through them. And there was a thrill when I would hit a new species. Good Lord, look at this thing from Nicaragua. I'm the first to see this amazing creature, which is the feeling I would get. But in between, when all of the work was being done, I was doing the drawing and taking the measurements, I was also thinking, I was meditating about biology and sometimes life in general.
I'm about to ask Dr. Wilson another question, but he puts me on hold while he reaches for the caltrop ant he's let me look at.
Let's see, where did I put caltrop? My box of caltrop, there's caltrop, yeah. That's the nightmare scenario when you're doing taxonomy, particularly if you borrowed a bunch of 70 to 120-year-old specimens from a European museum. You know, the thought of breaking the specimen is nightmarish. So that's part of the work that I like the least is unpacking and handling these extremely fragile but valuable specimens.
Dr. Wilson made his drawings in much the same way the first taxonomists had in the 18th century. And like them, when he wanted to compare or identify the specimens kept at other institutions, he had two options. Go to them, or if you're lucky enough to be one of the world's most famous scientists, have them mailed to you.
That's a high-risk procedure. I was able to get back every single specimen in good condition to every museum.
That isn't always the case. Harvard has loaned out specimens that have ended up mangled in the mail. But now there's a new way of doing things that became possible just as Dr. Wilson was finishing up his book.
I like to say that the huge work that I did with the drawings was the last of the great sailing ships, and that the new order entered with the CD-ROM that is pasted in the back.
That CD-ROM and the new order are based on a breakthrough in digital photography that captures exquisite details of each species. While Professor Wilson added small arrows to his drawings that call attention to important details, the electronic images are stunning close-ups. And to see how it's done, I just have to walk down the hall.
So now the trick is to get the lighting right. So what I would do, I would increase the lighting a little bit on the back of the head.
Okay.
Harvard professor Piotr Nazgrecki instructs a lab assistant on insect photography. As Dr. Nazgrecki tweaks the knob on a microscope, we watch the magnified face of a wasp appear on an adjacent computer screen.
This looks pretty good, actually. I would put a little more light on this eye so it's similar to the other one.
Until recently, photographing small organisms, anything under 2 inches, presented a big problem. That's because at high magnification, it's hard to keep everything in focus at the same time. So concentrate on an antenna, and the abdomen gets blurry. Sharpen up the image of a wing, and there go the back legs. To illustrate, Nazgrecki pans down to the foot of that wasp.
So what I'm doing, I'm moving the microscope up and down. And by doing that, I focus on a different part of the foot. Now, the distance between the element on the left, which is the attachment of the foot, to the tip of the foot, the distance, actually vertical difference between this and that point, is probably 0.1 millimeter. But it's big enough to completely throw it out of focus.
So you can only see one at a time. Really.
Right. So what we'll do, we'll try to take an automontage shot of it.
Automontage is the name of the computer system that searches out just the in-focus portion of a series of photos and combines those pieces into one perfect picture. There's other computer software that can do the same job, but Automontage is a full 60 times faster. It was originally developed for use in geology, but when biologists learned about it a few years ago, they realized what a powerful tool it could be for them. Since then, Nazgrecki has been working with the company that developed it to tweak it for taxonomists.
So for our purposes, for entomology and other biological sciences, this is a real breakthrough. So a researcher can identify that species without having to actually examine it in a microscope.
As Piotr Nazgrecki turns a knob ever so slightly, different parts of that wasp foot come into focus on screen. And with a click of a mouse, each image is digitally captured.
So I'm taking individual shots.
You're just waiting until a certain part comes into focus.
Right.
A couple of seconds later, the composite photo pops up.
Wow. So, again, all that we wanted to see, which is the foot and all the details of the foot, are perfectly in focus.
Am I right to call them hairs? Are these?
Yeah, you can call them hairs.
Okay. And a claw at the end.
And a claw. And this area here, which is kind of shriveled, it's called aerolium. This is the part that's sticky that allows insects to walk on glass and other things.
Okay. I mean, it's just kind of horrifying in all its detail, isn't it?
Beautiful.
It's beautiful, yeah.
Nazgrecki and his team plan to use this technology to photograph all of the reference specimens in Harvard's entomology collection, one of the most significant in North America, all 28,000 of them. Can't imagine where Harvard keeps 28,000 bugs? Once again, the answer's right down the hall.
Me and the janitors have lots of keys.
The keeper of the keys around here is Brian Farrell. His official title is Curator of Entomology at Harvard's Museum of Comparative Zoology. Farrell unlocks a heavy metal door, and we walk into a high-ceiling room lined with rows of gray metal cabinets, 700 in all.
And basically, this is the vault. You know, this is the sort of Fort Knox of this end of biodiversity. So these are the gold standard, really, by which our specimens collected from around the world are compared to decide whether or not they belong to this species or some other species.
The first thing you notice in here is the dizzying smell of mothballs. In this room, the only good bug is a dead one. Farrell walks to one of the cabinets and pulls open a drawer. The specimens that rest here in foam-lined boxes were collected from all over the world by Harvard researchers.
This is a collection of probably a dozen species of really large cerambycid beetles. This one here is a genus from the Peruvian Amazon, and their antennae, their long orange antennae, are festooned with these tufts of black hair. Every other segment, basically, like pom-poms arranged on a long orange wand. A really extraordinary looking beast.
Now, if I was a taxonomist who, for some reason, needed to examine this type specimen,
there really are few options. We only, with great hesitancy, trust the mail service to mail specimens like this, and really almost never out of country.
Harvard does allow researchers to examine these specimens here, but that travel can be prohibitively expensive, especially for scientists in the developing world, where most of the world's biodiversity resides. This is one of the big bottlenecks in species description, and before he came to Harvard, Piotr Nazgrecki knew its frustrations all too well.
I come from what I think could be described as a developing country. I come from Poland, and I very distinctly remember going through unbelievable hassles, trying to borrow specimens that people were very, very reluctant to send to Poland. So I know the other side of the coin.
Nazgrecki would like to see all major Western institutions break down this barrier by following Harvard's lead, digitize their collections, and put them on the web with unrestricted access. But Brian Farrell is breaking up that bottleneck in another way, taking technology on the road. As organic insecticide is sprayed onto trees in the Dominican Republic, a net under the fogger quickly fills with bugs. Brian Farrell took this video when he and a group of undergraduates came here for spring break in 2002. Not to party, but to BioBlitz, a frenetic week of insect collecting.
We collected about 500 species in that 1 week, and probably about half of them belong to known species.
Which means the other half await scientific description. That's not surprising, considering the insect fauna of the Dominican Republic is not well known. But what is surprising is what else Farrell and his tireless team of undergraduates did.
We barcoded everything, entered it into the database, took high-resolution digital images, and put everything on the web before the course was over.
And the bugs that were collected? You won't find them in that Fort Knox vault down the hall. That's because Farrell did something pretty radical for a field biologist. While he took home the photos, he left the actual specimens in the Dominican Republic at the Natural History Museum in Santo Domingo. And the automontage system he took down there, he also left that with the Dominican scientists.
Each month, by Federal Express, they send up a CD full of with the updates of images and information from the natural history collections there, and we mount them on the internet. Eventually, they'll have their own servers and be able to mount everything there.
So this searchable, growing database is accessible to all for free. As Farrell clicks through it on his office computer, I spot an unusual message.
Could you read that? Help
us with identifications. Yes, we've invited our taxonomist colleagues around the world to log on and look at the specimens, because in many cases they're of undescribed species. And so this is a way to basically jumpstart the description and knowledge of the biota.
Piotr Nazgrecki has already seen the effect of an online collection. Since he and colleagues put up a Katydids of the World database, he's seen a dramatic increase in the number of scientists from developing countries who've described new species of katydids.
So we have students in Central America and South America and Southeast Asia working on katydids only because, for the very first time, they are able to access information about the fauna of their own countries with absolutely no problem and for free.
Brian Farrell hopes his Dominican Republic expedition will serve as a model. He's already making plans for a similar bio and digital blitz in Cuba. Such piecemeal but important efforts will help to chip away, species by species, at the daunting task of completing a global taxonomic survey in a generation. Already, a number of similar efforts are underway. Researchers are carrying out surveys in Sweden, New Zealand, and Italy. In the U.S., national park officials are talking about more inventories similar to the one in the Smokies. The National Science Foundation has responded to intense lobbying by the taxonomic community and increased its budget for species identification and inventory efforts. And the NSF has just awarded a dozen more grants to fund taxonomy students. In the meantime, E.O. Wilson continues to use his bully pulpit to encourage, cajole, and implore the scientific community, indeed the global community, to discover what remains unknown. Back in his Harvard office, Professor Wilson is hardly resting on the laurels of his 800-page tome to the Phidoliant. That bioblitz Brian Farrell is organizing to Cuba, Professor Wilson intends to go along.
Have you worked in Cuba?
A long time ago, 1953. I spent part of a year down there, and I can't wait to get back.
E.O. Wilson is the living bridge between the old taxonomy and the new, one who, for most of his career, patiently sketched the intricate drawings that served as the basis of species identification for centuries. Yet he embraced the cutting-edge technology that took away the need for that skill. A scientist who remains enraptured by his chosen creature, yet one who sees the urgency of describing the full web of life.
You know, one of the reasons to take real pleasure from this future is that it does return us to the 19th century, in a sense. The world has to be explored by people who go out in the wild to some of the most interesting places in the wild and engage in physical adventure, like the athletic young men and women who are now working their way up into the canopies of the tropical rainforest. So it has that appeal that we can resume an exploration of a little-known planet, and that we can combine literal physical adventure with fundamental science.
Put in that way, who could resist such a call to action? For Living on Earth, I'm Diane Toomey in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
A Little Known Planet was produced and reported by Diane Toomey and edited by Chris Ballman. Andy Farnsworth mixed the program. Living on Earth is produced for the World Media Foundation. If you have any comments, you can share them with us at 800-218-9988. That's 800-218-9988. Or write to us at 20 Holland Street, Somerville, Massachusetts, 02144. Our email address is comments@loe.org. Once again, comments@loe.org. And you can hear our program anytime on our webpage at livingonearth.org. That's livingonearth.org. Allison Dean composed our themes. I'm Steve Curwood, executive producer. Thanks for listening.
Funding for Living on Earth comes from the National Science Foundation, supporting coverage of emerging science, and Stonyfield Farm. Organic yogurt, cultured soy, and smoothies. 10% of their profits are donated to support environmental causes and family farms. Learn more at stonyfield.com. Support also comes from NPR member stations and the Annenberg Foundation.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.